My cases involve custody and child support issues. I've also served as a pro tem circuit court judge here in Marion County, handling specifically domestic relations matters. As to House Bill 3055, as it is currently written, it would prevent the reoccurrence of certain events that actually happened to one of my clients last year. Under the law, anyone who seeks a Family Abuse Prevention Act restraining order must sign and file a petition with the court for that order. The statutory format of that petition is laid out in Oregon Revised Statute 107.718, subparagraph 3. It requires the signature to be notarized, which means, in essence, that the petitioner's identity has to be proven to the satisfaction of the notary. And usually that's the court clerk. However, notarization is not required when that same party moves for a voluntary withdrawal and dismissal of the restraining order. House Bill 3055, as currently written, would require that notarization. Last year, one of my clients had obtained a restraining order against the father for a child. The father never asked for a hearing to contest the order as he was entitled to under the law. However, he did consistently demand by telephone and whenever my client allowed visitation that the restraining order would be dropped. My client refused to comply with these demands. Eventually, the demands ceased. We later found out that at the same time that the demands ceased, the restraining order had been dismissed by the court, supposedly at the request of my own client. Fortunately, the father had taken no aggressive action towards my client before we were able to reinstate the restraining order. In most cases, including in Marion County, to voluntarily dismiss the restraining order, the petitioner not only has to sign and file a motion to that effect, but they also have to appear before the judge to explain why they want the order dismissed. However, my client did not appear before any judge, nor did she sign any documents asking for the dismissal of her restraining order. Indeed, it was not difficult to prove that someone had forged her signature on the motion for dismissal and then went before the judge claiming to be my own client. Since the State Court Administrator's Office was responsible for the printing and distribution of the forms that are used in restraining order matters, I had first written to them suggesting that the motion for dismissal be changed so that, like the petition for the restraining order, the motion for dismissal must be notarized. While the Administrator's Office was more than sympathetic to my client's problem, they pointed out that the statute, again 107.718, does not require the motion for dismissal to be notarized. They felt that they had no authority to make such a change on their own and that legislative action would be required. Generally, police action is retroactive in nature. Without the restraining order, my client would have had to wait until she was, once again, a victim of physical abuse before the police could have taken any action against her abuser. If the person who claimed to have been my client had to have her signature notarized and thus prove her identity, before she was able to file a motion for dismissal, my client's restraining order would not have been dismissed. I understand that before you have some Dash 2 amendments, and what those do is they conform ORS 107.718, which is the statute that specifies the format of the restraining order forms with the original bill, so there's not an inherent inconsistency in the statute.
So this is basically a non-controversial amendment, Dash 2?
I'm not aware of anyone opposing the Dash 2 amendment, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. And that does allow us to change the form as well as change the statute.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Okay.
If you wish, there is also a Dash 1 amendment that's before the committee.
Yes, I think you ought to go through it because there are some people who signed up against it. We need to get them on the record and see where they are. And
yes, ma'am.
The committee will make their choice.
Thank you, Judith.
You're welcome.
The Dash 1 amendment is also a matter that I had brought to my state legislator before I took this position, and he had introduced a bill to that effect, and unfortunately the House is getting absolutely nowhere with it for whatever reason. And
we'll find out in a little bit.
We'll find out, yes. The amendments do six things.
One thing you do, Mark, you learn how the process works around here.
Yes, ma'am.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you. First, the Dash 1 amendment would require the court to order all child support obligors to purchase life insurance in order to protect the support payments in case of their death. Second, the amendment would set a minimum amount of life insurance that the court can order. Third, they would require the support obligee i.e. the custodial parent, to be named as the sole primary beneficiary and the party's child or children as the sole secondary beneficiaries of the policy. Fourth, the amendment would tie the obligation to purchase life insurance to the protections that are already found in Oregon Revised Statute 107.820, where the court already has the discretion to require life insurance. Fifth, the amendment would eliminate the discretion of the court to reduce the child support obligor's responsibility, i.e. his periodic cash payments, by all or a portion of the cost of providing health and dental insurance when the insurance is not available through his or her employer or on a group basis. Finally, the amendments would require the support obligor to pay a proportional share of all reasonable and necessary medical expenses incurred by the child that are not paid by their health and dental insurance. Under Oregon Revised Statute 107.810 et sec., the court has the discretion to require a child support obligor to obtain life insurance in order to protect, in case of his or her death, the support that they would otherwise pay until the support obligation ends. While the odds are against a support obligor dying while he is still required to pay child support, it does happen. For example, I was involved in one case 3 years ago where, just after the divorce was completed, the father was killed in an automobile accident. Might also mention as a sideline, in this instance, both the parties were approximately 22, 23 years of age, if my memory serves right. The children were respectively 1 and 2 years of age. Were it not for the father's life insurance, my client would have had to raise these two children without the financial support that she would otherwise have been entitled to under the divorce decree. Unfortunately, due to the enactment of the recent child support guidelines, many attorneys and judges look only to the guidelines when establishing support. No attorney that I have dealt with since the adoption of the guidelines has ever asked for the life insurance. Likewise, I am not aware of any judge, except when I myself have brought the matter to their attention, of ever ordering the obligor to obtain the insurance. Even before the guidelines, there was no uniformity among the courts as to when life insurance was ordered. Frequently, the court's decision had as much to do with the judge's personal whim and whether life insurance had already existed as to whether or not it was needed.
Okay, why don't you sort of summarize this last?
Yes, ma'am. There is also, before the guidelines, no uniformity at all as to the amount that the court required in terms of the life insurance. If the life insurance amount is in excess of $10,000, Oregon Revised Statute 126.025 will prevent the monies to go into the custodial parent if the children are named as the direct primary beneficiaries. What will be required by statute instead is that a conservatorship be established that requires a bond, an annual review by the court, more expenses, more attorney fees, and so forth. Currently, at least from my perspective, a child support obligor contributes nothing to the health and medical expenses of the child. Under the guidelines, the obligor must provide health and dental insurance only when it is available at no cost through their place of employment or through their union. There is no duty to go elsewhere to obtain the insurance if it is not so available. And if there is a cost, the support order may reduce the child support obligation by a portion or by all of the amount of the insurance premiums. Since the guidelines were established, in every case that I am aware of, the support has always been reduced by a full dollar to dollar instead of a portion thereof or even nothing. It's just automatic reduction. Also under the guidelines, the amount that the obligor has to pay can be increased by a reasonable amount for reoccurring medical expenses and for the cost of the medical insurance that the custodial parent has. But if the reoccurring cost does not exist at the time that the support order is taken, or if the custodial parent does not have medical insurance, then the custodial parent must either go without that extra support or, when the need arises, face the hassle, the time, and the expense of taking the other parent back into court to get the additional support. In addition, child support increases under the law can only be prospective and not retroactive in nature. Therefore, by the time any medical expenses have been incurred up to the date that they get to court, those amounts are still the entire, the liability of the custodial parent.
Okay.
I've spoken with Judge Asmaskis. He asked me to mention to you that in instances where the obligated parent, the one paying child support, is can both obtain the insurance and can afford the insurance, he does require life insurance to be obtained. He has not read the Dash 1 amendments, but he favors the conception. I understand that Mr. Ellis from the Support Enforcement Division has some concerns. I've spoken with him. Him and I think we can settle our differences. I also understand that Mr. Stecker from the District Attorney's Office has concerns.
Well, yeah, and probably other people.
And other people as well.
Yes. We'll listen to him. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mark. Okay, we have Karen Berkowitz is gone, but we've got Maureen McKnight.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Maureen McKnight. I'm an attorney with Oregon Legal Services, and I'm here representing the Family Law Task Force of Oregon's legal aid programs. So I'm here representing the interests of low-income people, and we represent both obligors and obligees. And in situations like this, where there are obviously both sides affected, what position we take in policy forums, such as the legislature, is to maximize to the extent we can the income available to children and their custodial parents, except to the extent that the ability of the obligor to support himself is impaired. And we think that's what's going on in this, what would go on with this bill. We're concerned about the affordability aspect. Breaking it down first between medical insurance and life insurance, I'm speaking of the Dash 1 amendments, first of all. We support the printed bill and the Dash 2 amendments. But insofar as the Dash 1 amendments are concerned, we oppose them. And the medical insurance, for example, what the amendments would do is remove the discretion of the trier to reduce the amount of the cash award by the cost of the premium. The statute right now, our law, gives the trier, the judge or the administrative hearing officer, the discretion to decide that in an individual case. By removing that discretion, you are mandating in every case that support is ordered and insurance is required, and it's required if it's available, regardless of the cost, it's required. You are automatically increasing that cash amount by the cost of the premium. In many situations, the cost of the premium can be equal to, if not more, than the cost of the actual cash award. Another bill that this committee passed out this session, Senate Bill 220, does put a limit on the amount of the insurance such that the obligor could not be ordered to maintain insurance if that insurance costs more than the actual cash amount, but you've nevertheless these amendments, nevertheless, would leave some obligors in the situation that they would be paying X amount in cash and double and an increased amount, just double that amount, for the total support because their insurance would be just as much as the cash amount. We think the better approach is to leave the medical insurance issue the way it is, with giving the trier discretion in an individual case on whether or not they're going to reduce the cash award by the cost of the premium. An alternative, and I will just say that this approach was mentioned in some testimony on yet another bill raising this issue, 2973, which was heard by the Business and Consumer Affairs Committee, is some sort of proportionality. But frankly, given...
Hopefully we're going to, in the next 4 years, we'll have health care coverage for a lot more people than exists today, and so I think we ought to... I'm concerned about it on that basis.
Right. Given the need, I think, to enforce the way the guideline system is set up now and the need to enforce that and still recognizing the need to adjust for individual circumstances, particularly as I'm concerned with on behalf of low-income obligors, that discretion simply needs to remain. And frankly, in the life insurance aspect, our concern...
Can we move on?
Yeah. Sure. Yes.
Let's assume for a moment, because I certainly understand regarding the low-income. But what about the individual that, you know, I myself have constituents, well-paid engineers, Senator Hill for Mentor Graphics or something, that the additional obligation to pick up the medical premium for their family, I mean, you know, certainly does not hurt. When you're sitting at a $90,000 salary, I don't think it's too much to ask. of a former spouse.
Senator Hanby and Madam Chair, I agree. And this bill would not, basically would mandate it in that situation as well as in the situation of low-income obligors, but leaving the trier with discretion. I know no trier that would not order the insurance in the circumstances you describe, where you're simply leaving the trier with the discretion on whether or not the cash amount should be reduced. That's what the current law is. It gives discretion. This bill would mandate it. And again, trying
Thank
to keep
you very
my
much. Let's move on.
Same concern with life insurance. Thank you.
John Ellis. So life insurance, I guess I wouldn't invest in that for myself.
No, I know.
But we'll see.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. John Ellis from the Department of Justice. I don't want to take up any of your time that's unnecessary. I can only say that I support basically the position put forward by Maureen McKnight, and I would answer any questions. My testimony is being handed out. The child support guidelines are very finely tuned, or as well tuned as we can make them, and this committee worked very hard on them in 1989. And I really think that the Dash 1 amendments are very high-minded and very well-intentioned, and I have a high regard for Mark's intent on this, but I simply have to disagree with the result. I think it's going to upset the apple cart.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Carl Stecker? Carl wants it. Right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carl Stecker. I'm Marion County Deputy District Attorney. I will echo the sentiments expressed both by Mr. Ellis and by Ms. McKnight with regard to the low-income folks. However, I would also point out that our concern is that this would tip ultimately into an enforcement issue for the DAs and or SED. Our concern there is that it's not currently recognized as a federally reimbursable expense. And the consequence of that, of course, is that this is all paid for out of county or state general fund dollars. Were it to go that way, obviously that's not what the bill now proposes, yet ultimately that's where it could lead, and that's one of our concerns. Secondly, I would just mention that there is no authority at this time for the administrative law judges, the referees that issue support orders, to grant this type of a benefit, and that is not also in the bill. Apparently, it would be limited only then to judicial orders, and you might have a difference. I will point out that obviously this impacts different people in different manners. That is, there are some obligors who are elderly or older, who may have a heart condition, for whatever reason, are going to be paying a substantial premium for this benefit versus the young and able-bodied. I would wonder that actuarially how many people are really at risk and whether the benefits outweigh the costs. Finally, I would endorse the on page 2, section 13C, lines 21 through 22, the Dash 1 amendments, the proportionality, the payment of the any unreimbursed costs in proportion to the income of the two parties, that is appropriate, I think. That is the subject of this bill that Ms. McKnight referenced, and we would certainly support that
that's
idea.
That's coming, right?
That hopefully we'll make it here, yes.
No. Do you all want that piece of this amendment? If you do, you got to say it now.
I have no objection to it. I was referencing that proportionality.
You got to get up here so you can get on the record. Okay.
Maureen McKnight, for the record, the Family Law Task Force has no objection to that. There would be some enforcement concerns, however. I was referencing the proportionality in reference to resolving the premium cost and not the uninsureds.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Hey, John.
For the record, John Ellis again. I'm going to echo my colleague, Maureen McKnight. I think it would be very hard to collect this.
Okay, so your suggestion is we leave the Dash 1s alone.
I would.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, committee members.
Okay.
Sorry, Mark. You don't have, I sense you don't have the votes for the Dash 1 amendments. But we do have.
Move the Dash 2 amendments,
okay.
Madam Chair.
Okay, Senator Hill has moved the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3055. discussion, objections to the dash two amendments? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay, Senator Springer, are you okay on this? Got to do a little work here.
Okay.
Okay. Senator Hill.
And I'll move House Bill 3055 as amended to the floor.
Okay. Senator Hill moves House Bill 3055 to the floor with due pass recommendation as we've amended it. Discussion, call the roll, please.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you, folks, for waiting. Let's see what we have left here. We have 2994. Holly Prude is here. Judith Amata. David Nebel. And then we have three little bills left with one person signed up on them. Okay. 2994.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Nebel. I work for Oregon Legal Services, and I'm here representing the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. To my left is Holly Pruitt, the director of the coalition, and to my right is Judith Armada, the coalition staff attorney. I'm here to speak in favor of House Bill 2994, which is the coalition's highest priority bill for this session. The coalition is a group of 31 programs around the state that provide direct services to victims of domestic violence. And when we talk about domestic violence, we're basically talking about violence between adults who are or have been in intimate relationships with one another. This is a tremendous problem, as you probably know. 50% of all marriages in the country, it's estimated, suffer from domestic violence, and domestic violence is the leading cause of injury to women in our society. This bill was unopposed in the House. There were some amendments in the House that are acceptable to us. Law enforcement has taken no public position on this bill, although individuals in the law enforcement community testified in favor of the bill as it was amended in the House. The bill makes several substantive and procedural changes in the Family Abuse Prevention Act, which was originally passed in 1977. Section 1 provides a police officer at the scene of a domestic disturbance with a list of factors to consider in determining which party to arrest. This is designed to discourage the practice in some of our communities of a peace officer arresting both parties when there's been evidence that each has been injured in the incident. Under present law, just to review, a peace officer at the scene of a domestic disturbance must arrest the assailant or the potential assailant in a domestic disturbance when there's probable cause to believe that an assault has occurred or that one party has placed the other in serious fear of imminent bodily injury. The problem comes in determining who is the assailant. In some of our communities, the peace officer sort of begs that question and arrests both parties without making a real inquiry into which party is the assailant. This bill provides four factors for the peace officer to consider, among others, in trying to ascertain which party is in fact the assailant or the potential assailant. These factors are the comparative extent of the injuries or the serious threats of bodily injury, the history of the domestic violence between the parties, if that can be reasonably ascertained, whether either of the parties was acting in self-defense, and the potential for future assaults of one party by the other. The bill does not prohibit mutual arrests in appropriate cases. It simply directs the police officer to make an investigation to attempt to ascertain whether one or the other is really the assailant. This may be a difficult judgment in many cases, and we understand that, but I would also note in that connection that a peace officer that makes an arrest under the statute is immune from either civil or criminal liability, both civil and criminal liability, if the peace officer acts in good faith and without malice. So there is protection for the peace officers acting under the statute. Section 1 of the bill also makes a small housekeeping change to correct a jurisdictional amount. The statement of the jurisdictional amount of small claims court jurisdiction in the notice given to victims by peace officers at the scene of domestic violence. This amount has been changed in past sessions, but it wasn't corrected in this notice given to victims of domestic violence. Section 2 of the bill constitute amendments to the restraining order statute. The most significant of those amendments or changes is the deletion of the authority of the court to order mutual restraining orders. That's a provision that's in present law that allows a judge to restrain both parties from interfering or harassing the other party. These orders, mutual orders, are frequently entered either when a restraining order is originally procured by the petitioner, or in the course of the a hearing on the respondent's objections to the restraining order. When a mutual order is granted at the hearing stage, the petitioner usually has had no notice that this is even a possibility. Judges commonly just grant this without consulting the petitioner about whether it's okay, or granting it over the petitioner's objections, and often these are granted without any showing by the respondent that the petitioner has done anything that forms a basis for a restraining order.
You heard from judges on this? Our Clackamas County judges won't like this at all, you know.
I don't know about Clackamas County judges. I know that Judge Harrell in Multnomah County feels strongly that this is a good idea to delete the authority for mutual orders. I know also that the practice in Multnomah County has been to delete that authority from their form. They've removed that box on their forms. I also passed out to the committee something that looks like this. That's put out, that's an excerpt from a report made by the National County of Juvenile and Family Court Judges. Judge Harrell is the chair of that council. And this is an excerpt. This is not the whole report, but I've excerpted page 20, which is the last page in that packet, that the recommendation is that judges should not issue mutual protective restraining orders for the reasons that I've given, basically, that they're unfair. And also, another reason why we're concerned about mutual restraining orders as well as mutual arrests is that both of these things are disincentives, discourage people who this law is intended to protect from actually seeking the protection that the law is supposed to afford. If a person is being battered and they think that when they call the police, there's a chance or a good chance that they're going to be arrested and hauled off to jail as well as their attacker, this person's relative likelihood or their inclination to actually invoke the protection of the police.
Why don't you just go ahead? I'm happy to move on. I didn't mean to.
No, but I think that that's an important point, is that we don't want to chill people's access to the court system, and protection of the court system that has been established. I'd also say that nothing in this bill precludes a respondent from seeking a restraining order when the respondent has the grounds to do so in a separate proceeding. The respondent, if he or she wants a restraining order, can file his or her own. The other changes that are made in Section 2 of the bill are, first, that it authorizes municipal police officers to serve restraining orders in the following narrow circumstance: where the police officer is at the scene of a domestic disturbance, the respondent is at the scene, and a copy of the restraining order is reasonably available or available within a reasonable time for the peace officer to serve. We're not advocating that peace officer service become the norm here. We're just advocating that in that narrow instance, it's appropriate for a police officer who's on the scene to serve a restraining order that has not yet been otherwise served. Finally, the